Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is deputy editor Adrian Lowry. And coming up, Simon explores the art of patience with premium bonds. You may need to be patient to save for a comfortable retirement with costs on the rise. Talking of which, energy bills. We take a look at the small changes that can result in big savings, and we'll be exploring how you can avoid the greenwashing trap and invest in firms really trying to save the planet. Plus, the year-old used cars selling for almost a fifth more than what they cost new. But what tops the list? Don't be getting set up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, oh, how we love premium bonds. As a nation, we have £111 billion worth stashed in the grandparents' favourite savings lottery. While we know we probably won't win a million, and we realise we're probably unlikely to bag one of the rarer 150 or even 25k prizes, it's like so many things in life, the little wins that keep us going. Yet even those might be harder to come by than you think, according to a new piece of research, which worked out how long you'd have to wait for the prizes. By the way, for a better than half chance of winning £1 million of £1,000 in bonds, it's 3.2 million years. Simon, I know we like premium bonds, but I'm not sure they'll be around in 3.2 million years.
No, but it's worth noting that just because a data scientist has crunched the numbers and said that for a better than 50% chance, so it's not a guaranteed chance, but it's a better than 50% chance. And I'm not really sure how statistically that actually computes into being how close to guaranteed or not. But anyway, a better than 50% chance of winning £1 million with £1,000 in premium bonds, you would have to wait 3.2 million years. Does not mean that it won't happen, because in August, a woman from Devon won £1 million on the premium bonds, and she has £1,001 saved in them. I don't know how she managed to get £1,001 saved in premium bonds. And she bought those bonds a year earlier.
Right. I'm absolutely sure she's not.
So there you go. One year she waited, not 3.2 million. And it actually 3.2 million is rounding it down. It's actually 3,219,909.7 years that you would have to wait. I mean, you kind of round down to 3.2 million, but actually in terms of life expectancy being, I think, around kind of late 70s, early 80s, those extra 19,909.7 years do make a difference to the average human. Anyway, the point of this research was, I think, to try to explain in a different way to people what their likelihood of winning certain premium bond prizes is. Because National Savings and Investments is very open and honest about the odds of winning a prize, the odds of winning a prize with any individual bond, but it's not necessarily the way people's brains compute it. And so you might think, I think people probably think they're more likely to win £50 or £100 or £1,000 or whatever. Now, what it shows is to win any prize above the smallest £25 prize, you could be waiting quite a long time. So if you have £1,000 in premium bonds, not a huge amount compared to what many people have, but still a sizable sum of money, you would wait 2 years, okay, to have the better than 50% chance of winning a £25 prize. But you would wait 213 years to win a £50 one or a £100 one, 1,155 for a £500 one, and so on until we hit the 3.2 million that we were talking about a minute ago. The chance of winning any prize, right, so the £25 one, you would on average expect to wait 2 years. Now, just be clear, that doesn't mean everybody will wait 2 years. Lots of people will hardly wait any time at all. Some people will wait more than 2 years. It's a lottery, effectively. But you'd have to wait 94.7 years for any prize of £50 or more. And that obviously steps down as you have more of money in your bonds. I mean, it is worth noting that one of the other points of this piece of research is that it was commissioned from a data scientist called Andrew Zellin by Family Building Society, which has its own windfall bond, which is a rival prize-winning savings product to NS&I. So there's an obvious vested interest there. I think we need to be absolutely 100% clear. Yeah. But the reason why this is newsworthy and why it's interesting is because, as you said at the top of the show, people absolutely love premium bonds. And if we're going to go into the numbers, okay, so if you've got £15,000, that's quite a lot in premium bonds, you would wait 14.2 years. You would expect to wait 14.2 years to win a prize of £50 or £100, 77 years to win 500, and 214,660 to win a million. Even at the £50,000 level, you would expect to wait 4.3 years to win 50 or £100, 23 years to win 500, 69.3 to win 1,000. And it is worth noting at this point, two things. One, I had a poll on this article which asked people how much do you have in premium bonds. 43% of the people who voted, that's 788 people, to put it in context, said they had £40,000 to £50,000 in bonds.
Yeah, wow.
And actually the next most popular amount was 1,000 to 10,000. No, sorry, 10,000 to 20,000 with 14% of people. And then it was sort of spread fairly evenly around. And the other thing to note is that the comments on this story are absolutely packed full of people saying, well, I've got £1,000 in bonds and I want X or I want Y, and so on. But just because some statistician says one thing doesn't mean that your personal experience in life will be different. And the one thing this highlighted to me is the absolute fundamental importance of £25 prizes, because you have to wait much longer for those, much less time for those, because they are much more common. And actually, if you've got a decent holding in premium bonds, that's the thing that gets the money rolling in, not the bigger prizes. So they might not seem very exciting, but they are very important.
So Adrian, then, apart from dumping all your premium bonds and going to Family Building Society and buying the windfall bond savings product, what do you take from this?
Well, what you've got to do is look at the opportunity cost of holding a premium bond. So what else could you put your money in terms of savings accounts? At the moment, the best easy access pays 0.66%. The top 1 year fix is 1.5, 3 year 1.8, 5 year 2%. What a lot of people do, quite rightly, is try to compare the prize rate of premium bonds to that. Now, the annual prize rate at the moment is 1%. That does not mean that if you hold £1,000 worth of premium bonds, you are likely to get 1%. You can't start off with, because there isn't a £10 prize. There's only a £25 prize. It's also distorted at the top end by the £1 million prizes. That means that this average rate is not meaningless, but it's also not very meaningful. You're not going to win 1% a year, basically, especially not if you only hold £1,000 worth. What is more useful is this idea of the median. Now, if you do that, what you would expect to win in a year from various holdings is £100 zero, £1,000 zero. If you hold £1,000, of all the holders of £1,000, 70% will win nothing in any 1 year. Hold £5,000 worth, it's £25. And that is an interest rate in inverted commas of 0.5%. If you hold £30,000 worth, it's 250, an interest rate in inverted commas of 0.8%. And if you hold the full 50,000, it's 450. That's 0.9. You're getting close to the 1% there. So that tells you two things. Number one, obviously, the more you hold, the closer you get to this average 1% a year rate. And it also shows over the shorter term, you are almost certainly better off with an easy access savings account or a 1 year fix. The longer you go, the more competitive, as it were, the premium bond holding emerges to be. Also, you can get your premium bonds cash within anything from 3 to 8 days. So it is effectively easy access savings. What people think is, well, if I'm only missing out on this a few quid each year, if the savings account is slightly better, I'm prepared to sacrifice that few quid for the chance of something greater.
So I think premium bonds are a pretty good product, and I can see why people like them, right, for the reasons that Adrian just said there. I think other people around the world, I recall Lee once being contacted by someone in America who had read a story about premium bonds, were amazed by this government savings lottery that we had. We're like, wow, that is amazing. You know, there's lots of places that would quite like this kind of thing. And it is that little, it's the promise of a reasonable return on your money, government backed. So like, you're only going to lose all your money if the whole country goes under. You can get at your cash quite easily. You get a reasonable rate of return compared to the market, and you never know, you might win. Because like, yes, you're not going to win, okay? You, statistically speaking, you will not win, but two people every month do. So I can see why people like them. I do think that people hold too much money in premium bonds. The evidence of our poll showing that the 40 to 50,000 is 43%. And you know what? I wish I had put the 50,000 figure in there, because I think there's a lot that, but within that, there'll be a lot of people who've maxed out their premium bonds. And I think that if you are effectively holding £50,000 in cash, there's a very strong likelihood that you are holding too much of your wealth in cash. People should have their rainy day funds, the money they need for if something goes wrong, and a substantial amount of money. You know, people are advised to have maybe 3 months, sometimes even 6 months, you know, in case they lose their job. But that 3 months worth of money, you should have that in cash. Maybe you should have a buffer over and above that. Maybe you've got some money that you use for spending on holidays, things like that, or stuff to, you know, you save. If you're saving up to buy a house or something, obviously you need it in cash, right? If you need it immediately, you need it in cash. But there's lots of people who don't need the money immediately. There's lots of people with £50,000 in premium bonds that is well over and above their rainy day fund. They've probably got loads of cash sitting elsewhere in savings accounts. They don't need that money immediately. It's been sat there for years. Every time the maximum premium bond threshold goes up, they whack some more money in. Okay. Those are the people who should probably be investing that money instead. And yes, they have the chance of winning £1 million. They're probably not going to happen to them. They're going to win a lot. It's unlikely they're going to get an average return that is much better than the 1%. They'd have to be very lucky to do so. And over the years, if you compare it to a reasonably basic return from investing in the stock market, even just the kind of dividend-based total return of like 4% a year, roughly, that 3% that you're missing out on every year compounds up and really makes a difference. That said, I've got quite a bit of money in premium bonds. It's where my rainy day fund is, on the basis that it's a reasonable rate of return on the money, better than I'd be getting in an instant access savings account. I could get at it immediately if I wanted to. It's obviously backed by the government, and I'm stupid enough to think that maybe one day I might win £1 million.
Talking about NS&I, I imagine with an autumn statement on the way, we might get more information about the NS&I green savings bonds.
Well, we know we're getting them. We just don't know what they're going to pay. People have been eagerly awaiting this. The government's in a bit of a dilemma here, actually. It had a green gilt sale last month, and institutional investors absolutely smashed it in a rush to buy these green gilts, which meant that we got away with raising money that is theoretically going to go towards making us greener at a lower rate than we would have necessarily expected it. So it was priced at a yield of 0.87%, right, which was around about 0.025 percentage points lower than what would have been seen on a normal gilt at the time. So you can see that actually there's a demand, because institutions want to put money into green stuff so that they can say, we've got money in green stuff. This is a big thing about that, to say to their clients, yeah, it's in green stuff. Okay, so there's quite a lot of demand. It's exactly similar to ordinary people going, well, actually, no, I would like to put my money into maybe some green stuff that will do some good. So you could get away with offering a lower rate, but they kind of want to offer a better rate in order to, you know, the idea of this was to try and help savers through low rates and everything like that. So they're in a bit of a dilemma. And you can guarantee that if they offer a slightly higher rate, everybody's going to absolutely pile in. So I think they're sort of working backwards and forwards and on exactly how they kind of price this and where it lies in terms of bunging savers some extra cash versus costing the country extra money, because that's what it is ultimately. Because if they could raise the money on the global financial markets through green gilts at a yield of 0.87%, then that's the cost of them raising that money. And if they pay savers more than that, then they're bunging savers extra cash. But savers aren't going to be happy with any kind of fixed rate green bond that's coming in below 1%. And they're probably going to be hoping for maybe something knocking on the door of 2%.
Yeah, not for 3 years, Adrian. 3 years to lock your rate in with a couple of interest rate rises perhaps on the cards.
Indeed. Well, this is a new dilemma that savers have to factor in now, isn't it? That it does look like we might finally get meaningful interest rate rises for the first time in quite a while. In December, the markets are pricing in one move, then maybe almost certainly a move in the spring by the Bank of England. So yes, you know, it could be time for savers to sit tight before they start locking in for more than a year anyway. And looking at the rates, you know, the one-year rate of 1.5% fixed bond looks okay. The 2 and 3 5-year rates don't look fantastic. So yeah, maybe that's something to think about.
Well, it sounds a sort of a nice dilemma, I think, for savers, that rates will be going up. We can hope, Adrian, we can hope. Okay, we're going to put this to one side and we are going to grab our woolly jumpers and stick those on. We're going to turn the thermostat down a little, or if we're feeling somewhat extreme and antisocial, we can cover our windows with cling film, because there are lots of ways to cut down on rising energy bills this winter that don't have to cost a packet. Money Mail has produced a guide to the small changes that you can make to slash your heating bills and protect your cash. Just very briefly, Simon, remind us what's happening with energy bills. Do we actually have any energy providers left, or have they all just, all the little ones just gone now?
I think the nation is slowly inching its way towards having a single nationalised energy provider. Basically, we're going to reverse 40 years of what was regarded as progress within the energy industry. I joked yesterday in our meeting that it might be called Build Back Better British Gas. So,
would that be such a bad thing, Simon? Just, I mean, if you posited that, would that be so bad?
Yeah, for all the problems in the energy industry, I don't think going back to the bad old days of that one provider is probably the best thing. The competition was introduced for a reason, and there's lots of, you know, there's lots of countries around the world that tried to introduce competition as well. The problem is we allowed any kind of two-bit operation to become an energy firm. There definitely has been a major gap in the oversight there from Ofgem, which by and large isn't a bad regulator, actually, as watchdogs go. But there's it's been a bit asleep at the wheel with this one. The spike in gas prices has massively caught people out. There are global issues with that. There are European issues with that. There are geopolitical issues with that. And everybody has been caught out, and our energy industry, the way it's constructed, has been exposed, because there's a lot of small companies that don't really have any money and make much money on very low margins. And also, we are going to probably see a whole wave of suppliers go bust in the next few days, if reports are to be believed. There is a gas shipper. What's that? Well, that's quite an important part of the chain that has gone bust, a company called CNG that was backed by Glencore. So CNG basically has commercial arrangements with about 15 to 20 household energy suppliers, right? And as their gas shipper, it's responsible for arranging the transportation of the gas that they bought through the gas network. It's also responsible for some of the hedging that's going on, things like that. I was contacted by a friend who works in the energy industry earlier this week, though it said that this company was basically ceasing business, and that this was big news, and it was probably going to lead to a wave of energy companies going bust, that there are energy companies who have basically got 4 or 5 days to try and work out what on earth they're going to do. Otherwise, they're going to have to be buying gas at the market rate rather than at the lower price that they have booked it in at. And when they suddenly start finding that they're going to have to buy gas at the market rate, they're going to be in trouble. And we had three more energy suppliers go under this week. One was a very much smaller one, but two fairly big ones were Pure Planet and Colorado Energy, which is about 250,000 customers in total. And the interesting thing about Pure Planet is that it was partially backed by BP. And so BP's just looked at this and washed its hands of it and gone, right, well, we're getting out of this market. That's what's quite interesting about this CNG thing as well, is, you know, backed by Glencore. Glencore, which is a massive company, is gone, right, okay, we're getting out here. So if you've got huge global companies that have backed some of these companies in the gas industry to smaller or larger degrees bailing out, then you can see the stress that is in there. So anyway, what it means is basically the energy price cap has gone up. The energy price cap is probably going to go up again in next April, unless something miraculously happens. And so we're all going to see our bills go up, unless we're on fixed rate deals, in which case our bills will stay the same, unless our fixed rate deals run out. In which case our bills will suddenly go up because we'll probably get moved to the standard variable tariff. Mine runs out next March, so good timing. So we need to save some energy.
So, therefore, what can we do about it? I've already said we can put on a woolly jumper. That's okay. Thermostat down, yeah. Cling film on windows. I'll be honest with you. Yeah, I'm not a fan of that one. But what else is in there?
Some of the interesting ones that were flagged in the energy saving article, and people love an energy saving article, just to be clear, were things like your computer. So it says that laptops typically use 85% less electricity over a year than a desktop PC, which would save the average household £17 annually. For even bigger savings, consider switching to a tablet, which uses 70% less power than a laptop. Probably not going to help you if you're working from home, to be honest. Try doing your work from home on a tablet and drive me absolutely crazy. But that's quite interesting. I don't know why laptops use so much less power. The big one is heating. A smart thermostat will help you out and things like that. The kettle, £6 a year. Cooking, including water usage, accounts for 3% of a typical household's energy bill. So that using your kettle, switching to an eco kettle, which acts as a thermal flask, keeping water hot for 4 hours after it's boiled, could save you £6 a year. The fridge freezer, getting a better rated fridge freezer. That's going to have to buy a new fridge freezer for that. So it's going to cost you quite a bit. Replacing bulbs. That's never that popular with people because people are kind of holding on to some of those older bulbs because they think the light is better or warmer or whatever. I don't know how true that is now. I'm actually, so much stuff has changed with light bulbs. So much stuff has changed with light bulbs over the last 5 to 10 years that I'm totally confused as to what light bulbs we are allowed to use, not meant to use, what you can and can't buy, what I've just randomly got in the cupboard and what they're going to ban next. Okay. Yeah. Televisions. Televisions consume the most energy of our electronic devices. Save £7 a year by opting for a smaller TV. Yes, people, you do not need a TV that is the size of the entire wall in your house. This obsession with colossal TVs that dominate people's rooms. Honestly, I've got a smaller TV, and that's because my TV is 13 years old, which makes me think
that it's also
probably not that energy efficient. Yeah. Although it is green by definition of being 13 years old and us not having replaced the TV and been the old one. So that's some of them. Draft proofing, £25 a year from draft proofing. And actually, I tell you what, going back to the kind of personal reflection stuff, we live in a 1960s house, a not overly well constructed 1960s house. The top is like a timber A-frame kind of thing. The wind absolutely whips through the eaves upstairs in the bedrooms. So it is freezing in winter. It is very hot in summer. There's not really a lot we can do about that kind of insulation situation. And we are going to be doing some work on the house, so we'll sort it all out then. Downstairs, though, it's not so bad and it tends to be more of a constant temperature. But there are parts of the house where there's like the hallway's got single glazing. And then some double doors from the hallway then through into the lounge. And it used to get really cold out there. And that's where the door to the utility room and the garage is. And you would notice the cold air coming through, even if you shut the double doors. That made a big difference. But we bought some thick curtains and hung them up over the front door. It's all glass across the front. And we pull those. And that, after we bought those last winter, made a huge difference, actually, to the temperature in the whole of the downstairs of the house, surprisingly. Those curtains were not that expensive. We managed to find a decent pair of pretty thick curtains, had to take them up ourselves in order to get them to fit the doorway. But yeah, I reckon we probably still spent like 40 or 50 quid. So we're not going to save the money back in energy efficiency. But it certainly made a massive difference.
So good for your wallet, good for the environment making changes, which is where we're going to go next. Because as COP26 heads to Glasgow next month, expect the climate crisis to be making a fair number of headlines. We may also get a lot of green in the Chancellor's red box in his autumn statement in 2 weeks. Does he have a red box for his autumn statement, or is it just the budget?
This is technically called an autumn budget and spending review, I think.
Oh, whatever.
So they're like really, really, really muddying the waters. We went from having like the budget thing to the autumn statement, and the autumn statement became a budget, and then someone came in and said they were going to stop. I think it was Philip Hammond said we're going to stop having two of these every year. Now we seem to have gone back to two of them. And do you know what is really annoying? Rishi Sunak, I don't know what you're thinking, mate. Why have you put it in the middle of half term?
Oh, yeah. I don't think of these things. Be that as it may, whatever it's called and whatever it's carried in and whenever it is, it's not really about that anyway. I'm talking about doing good with our money. Problem is, how can you sort the ESG wheat from the chaff and work out whether the fund you're investing in is as green or sustainable as it's made out to be? This is pretty much across the board, whether it's investing, consumer, transparency is such an issue. It's so difficult, Adrian, isn't it? The rise in ESG, what am I talking about?
Well, ESG stands for Environment, Social and Governance, and is used as shorthand for the drive in the investment industry to make sure, or at least look like you're making sure, that the things you're investing in are not doing harm to the planet or people and are involved in good business practices. Now, on the one hand, obviously, this sounds like a great idea, and in some cases, it is a great idea. On the other, investment companies and other financial services companies have come under accusations of greenwashing, which means that they make a big song and dance about professing their ESG credentials through sticking the ESG badge on various funds, when actually, once you look under the bonnet of the funds, they aren't maybe what most people would think of something that is incredibly environmentally or socially friendly. At the very worst, all they would do is screen out a few negatives. They would just not include the big tobacco companies, the big oil producers, etc. That is probably, you know, the weakest form of ESG badging. In some cases, at the start of all this, maybe 10 years ago, some investment companies just took their old funds, chucked out a couple of stocks and stuck the ESG badge on. Things have got better since then. The industry is working to make sure that the term ESG means something, that the screening criteria are more strict, and there are plenty of really good funds out there that have, okay, a lot of them are still just screening out the negative stuff, but they're doing it in a much more aggressive fashion. They're raising the bar. At the same time, there are also funds that are trying to discriminate in a more positive way, i.e. they're looking for companies that are contributing to the fight against climate change, or that are contributing to socially productive sectors and that are encouraging good business practice, you know, the governance, you know, the G of ESG. So things are getting better. That doesn't mean that greenwashing doesn't still exist. It almost certainly does. And therefore, you know, the retail investor, the individual investor, still has to do their homework. They can't just sit in front of their laptop, see that a fund is ESG in inverted commas, and think that it's going to be what it says it is.
So how, Simon, do you effectively do your homework in this area? There's no standard process, is there? It's very difficult, isn't it? Because I suppose everybody has their own values.
It is difficult. I mean, the good news is that Meghan and Harry are going to totally sort this out.
Marvellous, yeah.
Because this is very topical at the moment, because they've got a new job with Ethic, which is a US, described as an investment firm. Asset manager is described as, but that makes me think of fund manager. There's a lot of people in Britain scratching their heads this week, financial journalists, who spent a disproportionate amount of their time trying to work out exactly what Ethic does.
Right.
Ethic appears, from my investigations, you don't actually invest with Ethic. You don't give Ethic your money and they invest it. They provide a service to wealth managers and things like that, so that they can tailor people's portfolios. They can do a tailored portfolio to people's ethical outlook and views, and Ethic helps people understand what those views might be. So sustainable, green, pro rights for all kinds of people who need rights being looked after, not anti-rights rule, all that kind of stuff, all bundled in and creates a kind of overlay. It's basically an example of how ESG, as Aid says, has become a phenomenal growth chunk of the investment industry. And with anything like that, you will get a certain amount of bandwagon jumping. I'm not saying ethic is bandwagon jumping, and I'm not saying that Meghan and Harry are bandwagon jumping, just to be absolutely clear. But there are lots of different things. There's sustainable, there's impact, there's ESG, there's green investing, there's all this kind of stuff. And amongst that, there are sustainable funds out there, for example, where you might think as an investor, I want a sustainable fund because that's going to help the planet be a better place and everything like that. And then you look at the top 10 holdings and you see Apple and you're thinking to yourself, why is Apple in here? What's Apple got to do with being sustainable? Well, some of the reason for that is that because Apple creates products, that means that people can connect without having to go places, for example. So less air miles because people can FaceTime or things like that. And also that it includes within the way it does business some sustainable practices, and it has a policy for this and a policy for that and everything. And then you remember it's a consumer electronics giant that makes loads of stuff in China that one of the main criticisms of is built-in obsolescence and that you can't fix that stuff properly. So you start to question how sustainable Apple is. But so you have to think about this as an investor. You'd think you'd just be able to rely on the funds to do it for you, but you can't. So if you really want to go for funds that are doing something kind of environmentally, you do have to start drilling down and going into the weeds. But many people don't want to do that. They just want investments in stuff that isn't doing bad things. So if you want to do the green thing, though, there are some established ones, a couple of investment trusts, Impacts Environmental Markets, Jupiter Green. These are actually investing in companies that work either to mitigate climate change or to do things to combat it. We talked about them before. Things like clean energy, energy efficiency, water treatment, pollution control, making agriculture more green, and also better yielding. So for example, you can use technology in agriculture that means that not only can you get better yields from the crops that you're growing, but you can also start to get rid of fertilizers, which are really damaging for the soil. There's a fund called Regnan Global Equity Impact Solutions. Similar thing. Holds companies around the world that contribute to a solution to one of the UN's sustainable development goals. Okay, so that's something that you'll see referenced. But I mean, I think what it means is that you basically, as an investor, you have to do some digging. We had another couple of recommendations. Jason Hollands of Best Invest recommended FPWHEB Sustainability Fund, which he said takes one of the most comprehensive approaches to sustainability. Zoe Gillespie at Brewin Dolphin singled out PICTET as a fund house that specializes in what you might call proper sustainable investment, highlighted global environmental opportunities. And also another fund that was mentioned was FP Octopus UK Future Generations, which is potentially worth looking into. But you do, I think, as an investor, need to have your eyes open and do a level of research that matches your level of desire to impact stuff versus your level of desire to just avoid some things. And the final thing I'd say about ESG, what makes ESG so intensely amusing from my point of view, is this the fund management industry admitting that previously they were totally open to investing in stuff that destroyed the environment, was no good for society, and they didn't care about governance? The best way I heard this explained, actually, by a very experienced fund manager, Mark Mobius, who's an emerging markets fund manager, was like, well, of course we want to do this. It's like, that's just how you run a good company.
If investors do want to back the transformation to renewable energy, the most popular way, or one of the most popular ways, is to put money into one of the investment trusts that back renewable infrastructure projects. Now, these are slightly different to the trusts that Simon mentioned, which are more broadly concerned with environmental sectors of various sorts. These are specifically investment trusts or fund, listed funds, if you like, that invest in wind and solar and increasingly other sorts of things like biomass, hydrogen, storage and energy efficiency. And they sometimes invest in just one project. You know, it's one investment trust that backs one big thing. Most of them, however, invest in various different stuff. Some of them are just solar, some of them are just wind, some of them are both. Some of them are focused on storage and energy efficiency, which is increasingly a concern. But what they all tend to have in common is they aren't so appealing from a growth point of view. You're not going to make lots of money from the capital appreciation in their share price. What they do offer is a very high yield. And so at a time, as we were discussing earlier with premium bonds and savings accounts, at a time when you're lucky to earn 1% a year on your savings, these do offer the opportunity to earn anything from 4 to 6, 7% even in some cases. You are taking a risk with your capital. It could go up, it could go down. The trend over the last few years has been up because obviously this is a growth sector. There is a certain amount of risk involved, obviously. If for some reason one of these technologies becomes obsolete, that investment trust that's heavily invested in it isn't going to do so well. In the meantime, the main obstacle to people from putting lots of money into this and earning a great 7% return every year is that they're quite expensive. They trade at a premium to their underlying assets. So the share price is, in some cases, 10, even 15% higher than the value of the underlying fund. In short, you could say you're paying over the odds. And the reason you're paying over the odds is because they offer this great yield. And it's quite a safe yield as well. It's not going to go up and down hugely year to year. Whether they're worth it or not, in that case, is a calculation, as with every investment, that the individual investor has to make.
All right, then. Indeed, that is true. We will put this to one side. And the Pension and Lifetime Savings Association's Retirement Living Standards was published this week. Sexy. But I have to say, I do think it is an incredibly useful way for people to understand, materially speaking, what their retirement could be like. We talk about pension. People don't want a pension. They want what it can do. To be comfortable, you'd need pension savings of nearly £250,000 to enjoy a retirement of 8-pound bottles of wine, 2 weeks in the med, and a restaurant budget of £500 a month. That seems quite a lot. But the bad news is, looking at the figures, is that due to COVID, they had to be revised and couples now need to find an extra £2,200 a year to keep up with this comfortable retirement lifestyle. Research also revealing how our spending priorities have changed. Simon, very briefly, what's going on? How have our spending habits changed? How much extra do we need to save? And £500 a month for restaurants. This makes me sound really tight, but that seems quite a lot, no? For a couple, even so.
I reckon you need to do a Excel download of your bank statement and your spending and then start like labeling stuff and then do an add up and tell us how much you end up spending on eating out in a month. And you're not allowed to do months when you're in Spain where it's cheaper. Because actually I think people might be surprised. A few big meals can really add up. I say this because I actually did exactly the same thing the other day. And I was like, what? I mean, to be fair, I did go out for 2 expensive meals. And I was like, okay, well, if I did take those out of the equation, that would reduce the total by quite a lot. But yeah, I was like, whoa, how did I spend that much? Look, this is possibly, with the exception of the investigations by our own Steve Webb and Tanya Jeffries that gave people loads of state pension back that they were underpaid, possibly the greatest piece of pensions research I've seen in recent years. Okay, it's by the PLSA, and it literally puts into people's heads a picture of what their retirement might look like and what it might cost them. And it is possibly just, it's the one that has garnered the most attention, the most headlines, the most engagement that I have seen over the last few years. They've done it a few times now. Mm-hmm. I'm very impressed by it. I'm also very impressed actually by the way some of our colleagues in the paper have laid out some of the graphics, because it really does make sense when you look at it like this. Just to be clear though, those people, the couples who need £50,000 a year, okay, for comfortable retirement, 49,700, but what's £300 between friends who spend too much money on going out to dinner? Or £33,600 for an individual. They're living pretty good, okay? They're spending a lot of money, okay? That's how they're getting away with spending £500 a month as a couple on eating out. It's because they're spending £50,000 a year, right? Okay, so you're getting your £94 a week shop at Sainsbury's. You're getting your £8 bottles of wine. You ask me how people's spending has changed. Here's a great illustration. The survey talks about three cans of punk IPA. every pensioner's favourite tipple.
Yeah,
you know, punk IPA. You've got, you know, every 6 weeks a cut and colour hair treatment. I'm guessing more of that money is going to go on one part of the couple than the other. £120 a year for perfume. You're doing 3 weeks holiday a year. That's 2 weeks in the Med and a week in the Canaries in the winter. You've got two cars that you're running and you're replacing each of those every 5 years. You got to up to £1,500 per person for clothing and footwear each year, spending £50 on each birthday present for, you know, friends and family and stuff. So you're living pretty good there. You're spending like someone who's earning quite a bit of money, which will unfortunately cost you. And lots of people think, yeah, that's the way I'd quite like to live. That's the way I live now. That's the way I'd quite like to live. The unfortunate news is that will cost you quite a lot of money, because that £50,000 a year, in order to fund that, is going to cost you a substantial amount. And just to do a little bit of number crunching here. Okay, so your state pension, right? The first thing you need to know is that the new flat rate state pension is the new flat rate state pension is £179.60 a week. That is about £9,300 a year. For an individual against that comfortable retirement, that leaves a £24,300 annual gap that they need to plug. For a couple who are combining both their state pensions, that leaves a £31,100 gap that they're going to need to plug. If you are lucky enough to have a final salary or other defined benefit scheme where your work guaranteed to pay you a set amount for every year that you were employed by them, you are much more likely to find it easier to hit the numbers and close that gap. If you have a defined contribution pension, well, the bad news is that working on the basis of an average safe level of income to draw from a retirement pot is about 4% a year. That's what people have always said. Some people say it's lower now, it's 3%, but let's say it's 4%. Let's be generous, right? A couple would need a combined pension pot of £777,500 to get that comfortable retirement. That's £388,750 each if it came equally from both partners. An individual is going to need a pension pot of £607,500. And that's what you would need right now. The problem is, for lots of people listening to this, is that they aren't retiring right now. Okay. It's not necessarily a problem for them, but it is that they'll be retiring in the future. And the cost of that comfortable existence will have gone up due to inflation. And that will mean that the pension pot that they need to reach will have gone up too. So you might sit here and think, okay, can I get my pension pot to hit 600 grand? Then I'll get my comfortable retirement. That only works if you're retiring now. Unfortunately, if you're retiring in 20 years, you need to get your pension pot to hit a lot more than 600,000 in order to get there.
Just take a look though here. I think I'm more moderate. I mean, I prefer, I think it looks like a Spanish red there. And Brooklyn beer, I think is my preferred choice over punk IPA and Carling. I mean, if you want to give anyone incentive to save for retirement, just say all you can afford is Carling. If you just go for the basic
three cans of Carling.
Oh, only three as well.
Yes. Second
you
price.
You wouldn't want any more, would you?
Second price is four cans of Carling a week.
Oh, good Lord. I sort of fall down on the 10 nights in the Med. I am now sort of 57 nights in Spain. But I think I'm more moderate. I think I'm more moderate. Anyway, finally, we are witnessing a never-before-seen spike in used car values in recent months. It means that some year-old vehicles are going for more money than you would have got them for brand new. What's going on?
Chip shortage.
Yeah? All right, then. Excellent.
Can't get new cars. That's the problem. And what that means is that people have gone crazy for buying used cars, and the price of used cars has bizarrely started rising. And the price of used cars is now, in many cases, more than the cost of buying some cars, not all of them, but it can be more expensive to buy a used version of some cars than it is to buy a new one. The difference being that you can't get your hands on the new one, but you can get your hands on the used one, which is why people are paying more money. Now, some of these cars featured within this research are fancy cars. Let's call them fancy cars. They're rare cars, okay? Right, so a Lamborghini Urus. You're going to be dropping £182,811 on a Lamborghini Urus, which is going to put a really big dent in that pension pot and comfortable retirement, okay? That, the used price, is £196,750, which is 7.6% premium. But that's a pretty rare kind of example. A 911, Turbo. Again, that's a 150 grand car. A Lotus Elise, much cheaper, 45 grand, but still a pretty specialist car. The surprising stuff in here is the Boggo stuff, the just the normal things, okay? So a Dacia Sandero would cost you £9,773 new, or you could pay £11,673 for a second-hand one-year-old one with 10,000 miles on the clock. Again, a Dacia Duster, £15,398 new, £16,395 at a year old. Even a Mini Cooper, right? I mean, you see a lot of Mini Coopers around. £21,424 new, £22,700 a year old. It is absolutely bonkers, and car dealers are scratching their heads over this scenario and also absolutely coining it in because they're making big margins on secondhand cars. I think ultimately the answer to this is if you don't need to buy a car now, don't buy a car now. Yeah. Unfortunately, some people find themselves in the position of needing to buy a car now.
Yeah. Or, Adrian, get on your bike.
you know me too well, Georgie. Well, my only input into this is we actually had to scrap our car recently. We had a 25-year-old Volvo S8, which was my wife's parents' car, and was going fine until somebody decided to steal the catalytic converter while it was parked on the street outside. And that meant, well, it meant two things. When I took it to be serviced, obviously, it must have been the first time after this happened, it was making a hell of a noise. And I thought, oh, well, there must be something wrong with the exhaust. And the people at the service garage said, you had your catalytic converter nicked and it's going to cost this much to replace it. And you might want to check whether that's worth it or not. And sure enough, it wasn't. So we got about £150 for its scrap, or maybe £200, which would have been more if it had the catalytic converter in it. And we are going to struggle through hiring and doing these car clubs, Zipcar, etc.
Yeah.
See how that goes. It will almost certainly save us loads of money. Whether it's sustainable in the long term, as in after 3 months, we might decide, actually, we can't do without a car, we've got to get one, that remains to be seen. I shall report back.
Well, it's a nice little test, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
All right.
I think that there is one point here to be made, right, which is that in 10 days' time, Sadiq Khan is bringing in the expanded ULEZ zone within the North and South Circular, okay, which hits a huge chunk of ordinary residential London. And if your car is not compliant, which is basically pretty much any diesel car that is more than about 5 years old, or any petrol car that's more than maybe 10 to 15 years old, right? Then you're going to have to pay £12.50 a day to drive your car 364 days a year, whatever time of day you drive it, 24 hours a day. That is coming in, and it's going to, that even if families just drive their car once a week, right? That is going to cost them £600 a year, right? At a point where we've got an energy bill price spike, we've got the food bill price spike, we've got an inflation spike, and it's actually very, very difficult to buy a replacement car, and the cost of replacement cars are going up. I do think that is not the greatest time to be bringing that in, and perhaps he should delay it.
We shall see.
I mean, I don't think he should be bringing it in anyway, but that's my personal opinion. But I do think that even if he is going to bring it in and going to stick to his guns, I really do not think that now is the time to be bringing it in.
Chances of him delaying it are?
Maybe one notch above zero. I don't know, those years you had to wait for the premium bond win with only £1,000 in line with that.
3.2. All right, then. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk, or you can tweet us at thisismoney, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcasts to find all podcasts past and join the debate and read the comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.